In the 1993 classic film, The Fugitive, U.S. Marshal Sam Garrard, he played by Tommy Lee Jones, chases escaped convict Dr. Richard Kimball, played by Harrison Ford. He chases him through the forests of Pennsylvania, across the city of Chicago, down the corridors of the hospital where Dr. Kimball practiced medicine. Garrard is relentless. Kimball is innocent. The fugitive is being hunted down for a crime he didn't commit. And yet somehow he manages to stay one step ahead of his pursuers. You've probably seen the movie. Well, today's chapters are all about Israel's fugitive. King Saul chases an innocent man, and he too is a relentless pursuer. Yet God is on David's side and helps him stay one step ahead of Saul and his posse. Saul, the ruling king, was jealous of David's victories and popularity. Despite David's unquestioned loyalty to the king, a paranoid Saul viewed him as a threat. Three times Saul tried to skewer David with a spear. Three times David escapes. And finally he realizes that it's hazardous to his health to stay in Saul's court. And so David has to flee. He's on the run. Last time we saw David escape to the priestly city of Nob, then to the Philistine city of Gath. Today he defends Keilah. He takes flight to Ziph, on to Maon, En Gedi, Carmel, and then back to Ziph. We catch up to David now in 1 Samuel chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, "Look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah, and they are robbing the threshing floors." Now, Keilah means citadel. It was a city 18 miles southwest of Jerusalem in the plain of Judea. It was harvest time, and the Philistine raiders, they were stealing grain. And whose job was it to defend this city, as well as all of Israeli territory? It was King Saul's, of course. But Saul was too busy fighting his friends and killing his priests and plotting to catch David to do his job. Saul was so self-centered, so bent on protecting his own position and power, that he had lost sight of the real enemy. And oh my, this can happen to us, can it? A new church pops up. A new person joins ours. And they become popular. So much so we feel threatened. We become jealous. Hey, trust God with whatever throne you sit on. God is in charge of who's in authority. Our job is to fight the enemy, not chunk spears at a David. Stay focused on building the kingdom, not throwing spears at each other. We'll never win battles if we forget who we're fighting. Well, verse 2 tells us, "Therefore David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' When told the Philistines had stolen Keilah's crop, David could have made two mistakes. On the one hand, he might have said, 'Well, that's Saul's job, not mine. I'm staying out of it,' and been guilty of apathy. Or he could have said, 'If Saul won't do it, I'll do it. Let's go,' and been guilty of presumption. But David is wise. He asked God. He asked God for direction. And the Lord said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah.' But David's men said to him, 'Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?'" Now recall chapter 22, verse 1. At the time, David and his men are in the cave of Adullam. They're hiding from King Saul. His men are afraid an attack against the Philistines is going to expose their whereabouts. And so David doesn't disagree with them. For unlike Saul, David wasn't a tyrant. It wasn't always his way or the highway. And so here he takes the concern of his men to heart, and he prays again. Perhaps he's misunderstood the Lord. You know, every good leader realizes he can be wrong. But in this incident, David isn't wrong, for he inquired of the Lord once again. And the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into your hand." And David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, and took away their livestock. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. But Saul hears of David's whereabouts, his movements. And since Keilah was a heavily fortified city, he thinks he can trap David within its walls. And so Saul calls up his army to battle. David, in turn, calls on God. He sends for the priest, Abiathar, to act in his priestly capacity and to intercede for him before God. We're told in verse 10, "Then David said, 'O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant.' And the Lord said, 'He will come down.' And then David said, 'Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?' And the Lord said, 'They will deliver you.'" You'd think these men of Keilah would be grateful to their deliverer. But no, they'll turn on David in a heartbeat. And so, David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went wherever they could go. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted the expedition. And notice the followers of David have now grown. From 400 to 600, they've grown by 50%. People are tiring of Saul's tyranny. They want to live under David's wise and benevolent leadership. And David stayed in the strongholds in the wilderness and remained in the mountains in the wilderness of Ziph, which was west of the Dead Sea. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. And it seems Saul had tabled his royal duties to focus solely on this manhunt. Saul is fixated. Tell you what's happened to Saul. That evil green monster, envy, is now controlling his life. And he's traipsing across the barren landscape while affairs of state go unattended. And so David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. And David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a forest. Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. Now David needed some encouragement. And it arrived in the form of an old friend, Jonathan. And I love the wording here. Jonathan strengthened his hand in God. Or literally strengthened his hold on God. At times we need the same thing, don't we? We need someone to strengthen our hold on God. Jonathan was able to rally David's faith. This is the power of a godly friendship. So often my sagging faith has been strengthened by the faith of a friend. And this is why you need to seek the right friends now, so that when you need them, they'll be there. Well, Jonathan said to David, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." And so the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed in the woods, and Jonathan went to his own house. Now understand, David is in the wilderness of Ziph. That means he's surrounded by Ziphites. And how do you trust people named Ziph? Ziphites. I mean, to me, the name just sounds suspicious. Are you ziffing me? What are you doing, ziffing me? I mean, Ziph. And sure enough, these Ziphites, they go to Saul. They squeal on David. They rat him out. They promise to turn him over to the king. But when Saul comes, the Ziphites tell David that Saul's coming and gives him time to flee deeper into the wilderness to Maon. These Ziphites were playing both sides. They were telling Saul what he wanted to hear and then David what he wanted to hear. Verse 25 tells us that David and his men fled into the wilderness of Maon and were pursued by Saul. Now all these place names in our text belong to what the Israelis today refer to as the Negev. It's a Hebrew word which means south, the south. Today, the Negev is an arid wilderness. But in biblical times, the region was full of vegetation. It was heavily forested. And it provided perfect hiding spots for David and his men. Of course, then and now, the temperature in the Negev can soar as high as 120 degrees in the summertime. Psalm 63 is prefaced, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah or in the Negev. It was probably written on a hot day in Maon, where he is now. David writes, "My soul thirsts for you, Lord, in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water." Well, Saul heard that David was in the Negev, verse 26. And then Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And so David made haste to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were encircling David and his men to take them. Saul was outmaneuvering David and almost had him surrounded when suddenly God comes to the rescue. An act of God's providence saves David. Verse 27. A messenger came to Saul saying, "Hasten and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land." Therefore Saul returned from pursuing David and went against the Philistines, and so they called that place the Rock of Escape. An emergency forces Saul back home. Psalm 54 is prefaced, a contemplation of David when the Ziphites went and said to Saul, "Is David not hiding with us?" Psalm 54 is a psalm in which David speaks of his faith. He says there, "I will praise your name, O Lord, for it is good, for he has delivered me out of all trouble." Verse 29, "Then David went up from there and dwelt in the strongholds at En-Gedi." On our tours to Israel, we always love to visit En-Gedi. Today, En-Gedi is a nature reserve on the western shore of the Dead Sea. It's an oasis in the middle of the desert. It's beautiful. En-Gedi is one of my favorite stops. Palm trees, bulrushes blowing in the breeze, waterfalls, little pools you can dip your feet in, abundant wildlife, and ice cream sandwiches in the gift shop. And you could die for those ice cream sandwiches. Many of David's phrases in the Psalms surely came from his time in En-Gedi. "He makes my feet like the feet of deer and sets me on my high places." He was watching the deer at En-Gedi. En-Gedi means the place of the wild goats. "Lead me to the rock that is higher than I, for you have been a shelter for me, a strong tower from my enemy." Again, he was speaking of En-Gedi. There is a huge cave with a collapsed ceiling in the back of the En-Gedi Wadi, or the ravine. And it would have made a perfect shelter from the heat and the wind and the rain and from a jealous king. The secluded oasis of En-Gedi was the perfect hideout for Israel's most wanted fugitive. Which brings us to chapter 24. Now it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, "Take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. Even now the ibex, or the mountain goats, they roam the cliffs of En-Gedi. Today they come down into the parking lot to eat the trash from the tourists. Probably those ice cream sandwich wrappers. And so he came to the sheepfolds by the road where there was a cave. And Saul went in to attend to his needs. In short, Saul stops for a potty break. You know, in ancient times, constipation was known as the curse of kings. A monarch's rich diet, along with the stress of his job, made loose bowels a common problem for most royalty. Well, Saul ducks into the cave to relieve himself. David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. When the lookout spotted Saul's troops, David ordered his men back to the rear of the cave. It was a big cave to tuck away 600 men. And Saul's caravan stops right in front of the very cave that David occupies. Talk about drama. This is amazing. And David's men can't believe it. A defenseless Saul is just a few yards away. When Saul comes in out of the light of day into the dark cave, he doesn't see David's men in the shadows. His grunts probably drowned out their whispers. Verse 4 tells us, the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.'" Notice what they're saying. They're saying, David, what an answer to prayer. God has arranged all this. Here's your opportunity to kill Saul before he kills us. Now remember, we call this period David's pre-king days. But understand, to his men at this time, these were just David's days. They didn't know anything about pre-king. These were just long days, hard days, brutal days, hopeless days. But this is their opportunity for relief. David has it within his power to kill this madman and end this brutal ordeal for everyone. David is within his rights. Saul hath thrown the spear at him first. David, please do it now, they say. Understand, there were 600 men in David's army, and 599 thought he was justified in ending Saul's life. Everyone assumed that God had delivered Saul into David's hands so that he could kill him. Only David figured that God had turned Saul over to him to see if he would bless him. What a huge test. Would David fear the Lord and honor God's anointed? It's interesting, when David can finally solve his Saul problem, we learn he's committed to something greater than freedom from his problems. There is a principle he deems important: respect for God's anointed. If he expects people to respect him when he becomes king, he needs to respect the king at hand. And there is a process that needs to play out. Exaltation comes from God. It's not taken into man's hands. And both principle and process are now more important to David than escaping bothersome problems. Are principles more important to you than just escaping your problems? Here's the ministry lesson David demonstrates. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. David is in the right. He has the opportunity, but that doesn't mean he can do as he pleases. This opportunity hasn't been given to David for him to use any way and for any reason. How much does David really want to please the Lord? I love the following prayer. Oh God, make me one of those rarest of souls who willingly waits for your time. My patient will must be lost in your own, and your will forever be mine. David waited on God. He knew just because he could didn't mean he should. And yet David isn't the perfect hero. He does use his advantage here to insult Saul. Notice verse 4 tells us, and David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now today, military rank is depicted on a uniform sleeve or on their collar or on their chest. But in antiquity, the hem of the robe revealed a soldier's status. Likewise, the borders of a kingly or priestly robe represented authority. And to clip off even a corner, a small corner of such a robe, was a serious insult. And here, check it out. David cuts corners. You knew it was coming. David cuts corners. Literally, he sneaks up to Saul's robe and he defaces its hem. But spiritually, he cut corners by letting the king live while cleverly diminishing him and his God-given authority in the eyes of his men. And I'm afraid some of us can cut corners. Oh, we desire God's will, but we're determined to pursue it our way, and we cut corners. Remember, more important to God than what we do is how we do it. More important to God than where we go is how we get there. We all know the principle, God's will, done God's way, will never lack God's blessing. Well, it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe. David knew that there was bitterness in his heart, and he feels guilty over what he's done. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord." Saul may have been a madman, but he was still God's man. And until God removed him, David's job was to respect the king. Understand, David was a man motivated by principle, not convenience. And so David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. Friends, in our struggle with evil, remember, our enemy beats us only if he causes us to act like him. Romans 12, verse 21 states, "Overcome evil with good." In his book, A Tale of Three Kings, the men are reading and in the Thursday night fellowship, Gene Edwards, he imagines the campfire conversation later that night between David and his general Joab. Let me read it to you. Joab walked directly in front of David, looked down on him, and began roaring his frustrations. "Many times he almost speared you to death in his palace. I saw that with my own eyes. Finally, you ran away. Now for years you have been nothing but a rabbit for him to chase. Furthermore, the whole world believes the lies he tells about you. The king has come, hunting every cave, pit, and hole on earth to find you and kill you like a dog. But tonight you had him at the end of his own spear and you did nothing. Look at us, we're animals again. Less than an hour ago you could have freed us all. Yes, we could all be free right now, free, and Israel too. She would be free. Why, David? Why did you not end these years of misery?" There was a long silence. Men shifted again uneasily. They were not accustomed to seeing David rebuked. "Because," said David very slowly and gently, "because once long ago Saul was not mad. He was young. He was great. Great in the eyes of God and men. And it was God who made him king. God, not men." Joab blazed back. "But now he's mad, and God is no longer with him. And David, he will kill you yet." This time it was David's answer that blazed with fire. "Better he kill me than I learn his ways. Better he kill me than I become as he is. I shall not practice the ways that cause kings to go mad. I will not throw spears, nor will I allow hatred to grow in my heart. I will not avenge. I will not destroy the Lord's anointed, not now, not ever." And Gene Edwards ends his chapter. "That night, men went to bed on cold, wet stone and muttered about their leaders' distorted, masochistic views of relationships to kings. Oh, but angels went to bed that night too and dreamed in the afterglow of that rare, rare day that God might yet be able to give his authority to a trustworthy vessel." God is going to entrust David with spiritual authority, for David has proven that he can handle it. Verse 8. "Now David also arose afterward, went out to the cave, and called out to Saul, saying, 'My lord the king.'" Now David has done another crazy thing in the eyes of his men. He's exposed his whereabouts. He's now a target. "And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks your harm? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord delivered you today into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you. But my eye spared you and said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand. And you know, David held up in his hand that little snippet of severed cloth. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. And can you imagine Saul? He's yanking his robe, he's checking. He sees the corner of his robe cut off. He's missing a corner. Yet you hunt my life to take it. Let the Lord judge between you and me, and let the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. For as the proverb of the ancient says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked. In short, wicked is as wicked does. Actions will reveal one's attitudes. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? David compares himself to a flea. Saul's army was 3,000 strong, five times David's band. David was just a flea to Saul. No threat. Why are you so upset with me? Therefore, let the Lord be judge and judge between you and me. Can we let the Lord be judge? Don't you know he can do a better job than we can? Don't you know he has all the information and we don't? We need to let the Lord be judge and see and plead my case and deliver me out of your hand. David believed vengeance belongs to God. It's not for you and I to punish our enemies. According to Jesus, our job is to love our enemies and do good to our haters. And so it was when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And then he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have shown this day how you have dealt well with me. For when the Lord delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely?" Yet that's what David had done for Saul. "Therefore may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house." And so David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. Saul had said all these right words before. David doesn't trust him. But God can now trust David, for he has passed a vital test. You know, it's interesting, the choice that David made that day in the darkness and privacy of that cave eventually impacted his public ministry. And I want you to know, it's how we handle power and authority in private, whether we cut corners, that ultimately determines our promotion in God's kingdom. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Well, chapter 25 begins with Samuel's death and burial at his home in Ramah. The nation gathers there to pay their final respects to the last of the judges and the first of the prophets, a great man named Samuel. And both David and Saul were there, by the way. They must have negotiated a ceasefire so they both could attend. Verse 1 tells us, David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran, that is further south into the Negev. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. And this man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, which means scoundrel. Scoundrel. And the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, a babe with brains. She was both gorgeous and godly, pure and pious and pretty, all at the same time. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. Here was a case of Beauty and the Beast. Nabal and Abigail were husband and wife, but character-wise, they were poles apart. If ever a couple classified as unequally yoked, this was it. Abigail ended up a peacemaker. Nabal, he was just a scoundrel. And apparently, Nabal and David had crossed paths before. At least their servants had. Earlier, David had helped Nabal's men when they were in need of food and water. Now David asked Nabal to return the favor. But notice verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. Who is this guy? He's just a flash in the pan, somebody striking out on his own. He's not going to get my help." Again, I tell you, he was a scoundrel. Verse 12, probably friends with the Ziphites. Verse 12. So David's young men turned on their heels and went back. And they came and told him all these words. And then David said to his men, "Every man gird on his sword." So every man girded on his sword, and David girded on his sword. About 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Let's get ready to rumble. It's time to teach this scoundrel a lesson, David says. But one of Nabal's men reported what had happened to Abigail, told her that her husband had needlessly infuriated David. And so Abigail springs into action. She hurriedly gathers 200 pita breads, 2 flasks of wine, 5 sheep on the barbie, 5 bushels of toasted grain, 100 bunches of raisins, 200 fig Newtons. And she runs to intercept David. It's interesting, David had refused to hurt the king, God's anointed, but he sure doesn't mind roughing up a scoundrel, I'll tell you that. Verse 23. Now when Abigail saw David, she hastened to dismount from the donkey, fell on her face before David and bowed to the ground. And so she fell at his feet and said, "On me, my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal." She knew he was a scoundrel. "For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." Abigail intercedes for her scoundrel husband. And she says to David, verse 28, "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." She then prays that God will sling out David's enemies like a rock from the pocket of a sling. And when David sits on the throne as God has ordained, he won't even remember Nabal's insult. Verse 32. Then David said to Abigail. And you can read the blessing that follows now. He commends Abigail for her wisdom. He had used up all his restraint in dealing with Saul. Nabal would have tasted his fury if not for his wise wife. And you'd think after dealing wisely with a king, an encounter with a scoundrel would have been easy. But David was led by the Spirit when he encountered Saul. He was walking in the flesh when he encountered Nabal. And that, my friend, makes all the difference. It was A.W. Pink who said this, "The strongest are weak as water as soon as the power of the Spirit is withdrawn. The most mature act foolish the moment he is left to himself. None of us has reserved strength or wisdom to draw from. Our source of sufficiency is treasured up in Christ. And as soon as communion with him is broken, as soon as we cease looking alone to him for help, we become helpless." And this would have happened to David. But thankfully, a wise gal came to his rescue, which has also saved me from many a foolish move. a wise wife. Verse 36. Now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was, holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Therefore she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. And so it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. Talk about a hangover. Sounds like Nabal had a stroke. Ended up paralyzed. And then it came about 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Which made the wise and wonderful Abigail a widow, now eligible to remarry, a fact that doesn't go unnoticed by David. In fact, when David hears of Nabal's demise, he thanks God for giving the scoundrel what he deserved. And then, wasting no time, he sends his servants to propose marriage to Abigail. It might have been more romantic if he'd done it himself. Don't get sending your servants to propose marriage, but Abigail still accepts. Verse 41. Then she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, "Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And as I recall, 46 years ago, that's exactly how my wife replied to me when I proposed. Hell, maybe not in those exact words, but. In all seriousness, think of this from Abigail's point of view. She moves up, wouldn't you say? Yesterday she was married to a scoundrel. Today she's the wife of the soon-to-be king. Which is exactly what has happened to you, my friend. The day you gave your life to Jesus, you moved up. You are now married to the soon-to-be king. Verse 42. And so Abigail rose in haste and on a donkey, attended by 5 of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. And here is the application. A believer in Jesus married to a Nabal, oh my, is unequally yoked, which can make for a tough and difficult life and relationship. Maybe your spouse isn't quite a scoundrel, but they're an unbeliever. And you'd love to see life differently. You'd love for the two of you to see life the same, but you see life differently. You wish you could share your life with Jesus, with your spouse, but you can't. And you surely wish your spouse had a little godly wisdom, so you didn't have to always go behind him all the time, cleaning up his messes. You know, there's a country song that sort of sums up your frustration. I don't want no more of the cheese. I just want out of the trap. Maybe that's how you've been feeling. But learn from Abigail. Rather than feel stuck with your spouse, she did two things. She stuck by him and she stuck up for him. And in the end, her life with Nabal shaped the woman that David admired. And if you're married to a Nabal, God will use your marriage to make you more pleasing to the Son of David, Jesus Christ. Of course, verse 43 reminds us that though we can learn from biblical characters, they lived in a different era with different customs. For when Abigail enters her new household, guess what? She finds a roommate. For David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and so both of them were his wives. But Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti. David will ultimately marry at least 5 more wives who will birth him a total of at least 21 children. Now in chapter 26, our old friends, the Ziphites, are at it again, ratting out David. Now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah saying, "Is David not hiding in the hill of Hakalah opposite Jazamon. Now, the last time Saul conspired with Ziph, he almost caught up with David. Saul had David surrounded when he was called home to address a Philistine attack. God had delivered David. This time, Saul's 3,000 troops camp in the forest of Ziph. And David sends out spies. They're good spies. In fact, they do such a good job with reconnaissance that they know exactly where Saul is sleeping, where he's unrolled his sleeping bag. Verse 5. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay. And Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. General Abner was also his bodyguard. And so Saul is sleeping now in the midst of 3,000 troops with a bodyguard by his side. Verse 7. So David and Abishai, they came to the people by night. And there Saul lay sleeping within the camp with his spear stuck in the ground by his head. On the battlefield, the king's spear was the equivalent of his scepter. And this is why Saul always kept it by his side. But imagine the feelings that that spear conjured up in David. Saul had thrown that spear at him three times. That spear represented Saul's unjust and abusive use of power. And Abishai also had grown to hate that spear. And Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now, therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time. He's saying, David, that's the spear Saul threw at you. Now let's throw it back. And we'll only have to do it once, trust me. Here's a question for you. What do you do when someone throws a spear at you? Almost everyone throws it back. But David was not like everyone else. And thus God trusted him with leadership. David knew how spiritual authority is to be used. See, all too often we're inclined to bristle up. Oh, don't get pushed around. Take a stand. Well, David did take a stand. But it meant not throwing that spear that had been thrown at him. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said, furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. In other words, God will deal with Saul as he sees fit. God will take vengeance on the king just as he had on the scoundrel. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please, take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head and let us go. So David took the spear and the jug by Saul's head and they got away. And no man saw it or knew it or awoke, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. David goes back to the other side of the valley. And now he calls out to Abner. He taunts the king's bodyguard for not doing his job. He tells him to look for the king's spear and canteen. Abner spins around and realizes those two items are missing. And that's when Saul recognizes David's voice. And David asks Saul, why does he constantly hunt down a man who only wants to serve his king? Verse 21. And then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, here is the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it. May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. And he certainly did. Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail. And so David went on his way, And Saul returned to his place. And these two men, whose lives were so intertwined, will never see each other again after this incident. A few years will elapse before Saul is killed and David is crowned.